It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. In North America, as much as $1 billion worth of wood is poached each year. Trees that are illegally harvested off public lands to become coffee tables, guitar soundboards, countertops, and more. Tree poaching, which has had a long and complicated history, can inflict irreversible damage to centuries-old redwoods and other trees. But the motives behind those thefts aren't always as clear-cut as turning a quick profit. Join this discussion on both sides of the tree poaching problem in Wisconsin and elsewhere. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lindsay Borgun is a writer, oral historian, and a 2018 National Geographic Explorer based in British Columbia. She's the author of Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. Lindsay, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You have spoken to tree poachers themselves. My biggest question when we were talking about this and when I grabbed the book, why do people do it? Why do people steal trees?
Well, there's a myriad of reasons, but really what I explore in the book are the socioeconomic kind of motivations behind tree poaching. So in many cases, when I was speaking with poachers, they were expressing to me that they knew how to log. They were often from logging backgrounds, and they had a real kind of pressing need for the financial payoff that would come from this crime.
What qualifies as timber poaching?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it happens kind of across the board in all sorts of ways. So what I track in the book is poaching of old growth trees, often from Forest Service land or national parkland even. But tree poaching also happens from privately owned timberlands. It happens from privately owned residential land. It can occur even on like a smaller scale in city arboretums and city botanic gardens. Or city parks. You know, sometimes during the Christmas season, you'll see a tick in tree poaching for small Christmas trees. So it happens on sort of stratified various levels. And then in the book as well, I discuss larger scale timber poaching from the global south, particularly Peru. And that, you know, we often might think of that as illegal logging. But in the context that I'm speaking about it in the book, it's poaching old growth trees from conservation areas that are managed by indigenous populations.
In your book, you say that you have begun to see the act of timber poaching as not just a dramatic environmental crime, but something deeper. And you talk about the sense of control that people have when they do that. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So in the book, you know, we follow some cases, particularly of redwood burl poaching. And so this is happening from state parks and national parks in Northern California. And often it's happening in towns, often it's happening around towns that used to be logging towns, that used to be mill towns, that had logging economies, that over the end of the 20th century and continuing now, those economies have crashed or significantly declined. And in the wake of that, there are towns with really kind of large number or large amounts of unemployment and a lot of kind of anger and hurt around that unemployment and around the decline of industry. And timber poaching is one way that identity of being a logger and working in that industry is reinforced and brought back.
Who buys the wood from tree poachers? Mm-hmm. Do they know that it's been poached?
Well, it depends on the type of wood, actually, where it ends up. So in the case of redwood burls, they often end up in burl shops, which are their own kind of little micro economy along the Pacific Northwest coast in Oregon and Northern California. And sometimes those shops are run by shop owners who might sell slabs of burl for to artisans that will then make something out of it, or they themselves are the artisans and they'll turn it into these really beautiful works of art, like bowls or statues and different sort, you know, maybe even tabletops if the burl is large enough. But as you kind of stretch north up the Pacific Northwest coast and you see poaching of different kinds of wood, you know, then that wood is sometimes making it to mills. So I'm thinking in particular of Douglas fir, which is often poached from where I live in British Columbia. And those are often taken to mills. Sometimes the mill owner doesn't ask questions about where the wood came from. Sometimes people are quite savvy and they will forge paperwork that might make it seem like the wood was harvested off of land that they have the right to log on. But it really is on a case-by-case basis whether the kind of buyer knows where the wood came from. In a lot of cases, with trees that are preserved, it can be almost assumed when you see it. And if you kind of look at a log or you look at the wood that's being brought in and you can identify that this is very old growth wood, that chances are it has been taken from somewhere it shouldn't have been logged from.
We're talking about tree poaching and the culture surrounding it. We have the author, Lindsay Borgun. She's written a new book called Tree Thieves. What are some of the environmental effects of tree poaching that we can see?
Yeah, so there's kind of myriad. And again, it depends on the region in which the poaching is taking place. But in much of what I write about in the book is taking place in national forests, state forests, and national parks. And because there is so little old growth left in the Pacific Northwest and also in North America in general, what we do have left is very important. And old growth, excuse me, old growth is known for being a carbon sink. So it actually holds within it more carbon than second growth forests can. And so even though it may seem like one or two trees taken here or there, because there's so little old growth left, we're actually removing a very important carbon sink from the environment. And it will take another 2,000 years to grow that back. So it's a very kind of imminent concern. As well, those types of forests are home to all sorts of biodiversity that rely on the trees, even when trees are dead standing, which means that they've already kind of died, you know, for one reason or another. Maybe it's fungal infection or lightning strike or what have you. If it's still standing, often there are still animals that are roosting in it or fungi that are growing on it, other sort of plants that are relying on that log and that standing dead tree to survive themselves. And so they play a really integral role in the forest. And even outside of those types of preservation areas or conservation areas, when trees are poached, it really destabilizes the kind of biodiversity of a forest. And so even alongside riverbanks, for instance, it can really lead to erosion and kind of a breaking down of the cycle of the forest itself.
Explorer and historian Lindsay Borgun stays with us. We're talking about her new book, examining the history and culture of tree poaching in North America. Join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We're talking about illegal tree poaching with author Lindsay Borgun, who has spent years researching this phenomenon. Her new book is called Tree Thieves, Crime and Survival in North America's Woods. Does the extent of tree poaching in Wisconsin and beyond surprise you? Join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. In your new book, you say the scale of timber poaching varies by region. So what's happening in the Midwest, including Wisconsin? What do you see?
Yeah. So there, you know, as you can imagine, as the species of tree changes, the context of poaching changes as well. But that doesn't mean that, you know, the Midwest, just because it's a different environment than the kind of towering, kind of iconic old growth of the Pacific Northwest, that doesn't mean that its forests are immune to tree poaching. And so kind of one of the more, I think in the book, I call it up and coming, but, you know, I was recently interviewing a Forest Service researcher who said that Eastern black walnut is really actually the kind of most poached tree from this part of the world. And, you know, he says it's no longer up and coming. It's really kind of arrived. And so that is one tree up. It has a very large natural scope. So it spans all, you know, quite a large part of the United States and the Midwest. And so that is one tree that is increasingly poached. And actually it's poached to the point where the Forest Service is now involved in research efforts to stem that poaching. And they work with a organization called Adventure Scientists, who is going out into the field. They send out researchers, folks that might be in the forest already, to take core samples from these trees and to help create a database that might be able to show where the most poaching is happening. So that's one tree that's really kind of in demand, I suppose. But, mm-hmm. Oak is really sought after as well. So it really depends, I suppose, on the location itself. There also was quite a well-discussed case of a theft or a poaching from an arboretum in Wisconsin. So I think in the end that ended up being a sort of a prank that was pulled during a university rush week. But oh, sure. Anyway, mm-hmm. Yeah,
I remember
as you
that.
Do, mm-hmm. You get people to go steal trees. So yeah, you remember that? Hey?
I do. Yes.
Yeah. You know, it got a lot of attention, but actually, you know, people steal from arboretums all the time. You know, people also steal bonsai and all sorts of other rare plants. So yeah, it happens in much the same way. And the motivations are very similar, you know, which is that they're across the country, there's a real kind of challenge with economic stability in a lot of resource towns and rural areas that really make the stakes of doing this type of crime worth it.
Which trees are the most profitable? You mentioned a couple in Wisconsin, but are we talking about perhaps the redwoods or what's targeted the most?
Yeah.
Like nationwide.
Anything that can be used for firewood, you know, so this is kind of a consistent economy across the entire country. So, you know, Douglas fir, where I live and through much of the Pacific Northwest is very often poached and chopped up for firewood and sold almost immediately kind of through Facebook Marketplace or you know, Kijiji or other online forums. So any type of wood that you might burn is really the most immediate economy. I mean, you can get a lot of money for a nice piece of redwood or a nice piece of figured maple. That definitely has its own market for musical instruments. But a lot of the wood is going to firewood.
We're talking about poaching trees with Lindsay Borgun. She's a writer, oral historian, and 2018 National Geographic Explorer based in British Columbia. You say corporations are responsible for the frequency of tree poaching. Why is that?
Well, I don't think they're directly responsible, but I would say that decisions that have been made around logging in the past have actually led to a situation where poaching now is not necessary for a lot of people, first of all, and also kind of understood in a way. And so in regions where logging, I speak kind of most knowledgeably about the Pacific Northwest, but this is a consistent sort of trend in the industry. So in regions where logging was once the main employer, often what happens is that corporations, logging companies, encouraged logging at a rate that was not sustainable. And so until those loggers reached the Pacific Northwest, there was this kind of idea that you would just continue logging kind of across the board as you went, and that there were always going to be trees in North America to take down. And as kind of large scale clear cut logging ended up kind of taking off in the mid 20th century or so, that logging was happening at an increased rate. And there wasn't a lot of reflective thought at the time of what does this mean for our employees. There was a lot of that happening on the union level and on the employee level, but not at the corporate level. And so eventually what happened is that when logging had to slow for various reasons, particularly overlogging, entire towns were left in the lurch and entire communities were left, thinking, well, we had established this town and this work and this way of life, and now we're told just to stop it. And so for many people that didn't want to leave the areas where they were from, where they were raising their family, where they had really grown roots and made some attachments, that left a really big hole, not just economically, but through identity as well, and through the idea of who are we when we're at work and what does our family do? And that was really a strong motivation that a lot of poachers spoke about with me. So, in my interviews in particular with poachers in Northern California, there was a real resentment and a real anger around the fact that this was how they had grown up. This was kind of what a lot of, particularly men, it's a very male industry, what they had been told that they would do and how they fit in the world and how they fit where they lived. And they saw that as being taken away from them. And so when I was asking poachers, why do you poach or why did you do this? It was like, well, this is what I know how to do. I needed the money. And by the way, this would have been land that I would have logged anyway if I had been allowed to work.
What drew you to this research in the first place?
Well, that sentiment, actually, because I think when I first started, I thought, well, this will be an interesting crime story, and I will follow some rangers and follow maybe one or two cases, and it would make a really good magazine story. And as I dug into it and I started reading the history around poaching as well, I realized that this was really complicated and really interesting on the scale of identity and how people kind of relate to where they live and who they are as it relates to work. And, I was really interested in the justification of poaching that I was hearing in my, both in my reading, because that is not a unique, what I was hearing from poachers today is not a unique justification for poaching, that people have been saying that since, the mm-hmm. medieval times almost. So
did that surprise you? Did the justification?
Yeah,
it did.
Yeah, it did for sure. I think because until then, I actually hadn't heard anyone say that. But then it also kind of made sense. I mean, we have all these folk tales around Robin Hood and kind of folks that take from the rich and give to the poor, or are conducting crimes, but with a sort of moral imperative behind them. And I don't think that I thought that tree poaching would fall within that. But for many people, it does.
Our guest is Lindsay Borgun. She is a 2018 National Geographic Explorer. She's based in British Columbia. Her new book, Tree Thieves, examines tree poaching and forest conservation history in North America. She has spoken with poachers and written about their motivations in her book, and she joins us for the hour. Join in this conversation. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. Continuing our discussion on timber poaching. It's a crime that foresters say is pervasive nationwide, including in Wisconsin. You can join in this discussion on how tree theft is in force and the consequences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Explorer and historian Lindsay Borgun stays with us. And we have Mark on the line from Dodgeville. Hi, Mark.
Hey, thanks for letting me in. I've been a forester around here for about 40 years. I've been involved in some investigations in southern Wisconsin of tree theft. There are some very distinctive features in trees. The annual rings are different from one tree to another in most cases. And anything unusual like burls on redwood trees, there's almost none of them that match each other. They can be traced fairly easily if you can find where the logs are possibly gone to. And in these great digital ages now, we can take a picture of the stump and a picture of the base of the log and match them up quite exactly.
Mark, that's really interesting. So you've done this, actually. You've been a part of these investigations?
Yes. I find law enforcement is kind of hesitant to get involved. So often we have situations where we feel we can probably track down the logs that have been stolen, but we have a real slowdown in law enforcement. They don't know about it, or they're not comfortable, or the DA doesn't know how to handle it. So there are quite a few where we could have investigated but didn't because we can't get the momentum going. But I have been involved in a few. We have managed to match things up a little bit in some cases. It's very doable, and yet it doesn't get done very much. So my question is, how much experience or how much has Lindsay seen in trying to track down and investigate these thefts?
Thanks, Mark. Lindsay, what do you say to Mark? And you actually in your book say that poaching is complex to investigate and prosecute. Why?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, I'm interested. Thank you very much for calling in with that perspective because, you know, I think when, you know, especially when I was interviewing Park Service Rangers and Forest Service Rangers, they actually had a hard time locating the stumps. So you're absolutely correct that often they would seize wood and it would have a very distinctive grain. You know, in Washington, you've got kind of this kind of flame maple that has this really beautiful grain to it. And you're right, a redwood burl, you know, you can really kind of match that wood. But it, for them, it was actually finding the stump that became quite difficult, you know. It would be almost this kind of serendipitous thing that would need to happen where they would, you know, maybe someone would find the poaching site through other work and it perhaps would have been somewhat fresh and then the wood hadn't been sold yet. So anyway, that was a challenge that I was hearing. And you're echoing a lot of what I heard from rangers, which is that it becomes quite difficult to get the DA involved. And partly that's because timber theft is, as I'm sure you know, is treated as a property crime. And so if the dollar figure isn't seen to be that much, it might not be actually worth the time overall, or at least that was the suspicion of some folks that I had interviewed. So I do follow the investigations of a couple poaching cases in the book. Both of those cases were of Redwood Burl, and it actually happened that independent researchers had found the burl poaching sites and reported it to the Park Service. And the Park Service was able to kind of start going around to burl shops and asking around. It took many months actually to build up both of those cases. It required the cooperation of burl shop owners. And, you know, they can't always assume that mill owners or burl shop owners are actually going to be cooperative, you know, so it took some kind of finessing on their part there. For various reasons. I mean, sometimes people just don't want to cooperate with law enforcement, you know, for whatever reason. And unfortunately, you know, some regions, they don't always have a very kind of positive connotation with parks themselves. And so they don't want to be seen as helping Park Service rangers in their investigations. So that is my experience in kind of getting to know those. There are also some really interesting developments that are coming about with researchers in the Forest Service that are working to be able to identify where a piece of wood has come from only through the seized wood. And they're doing that by creating a DNA database. So very kind of interesting work that would mean that they wouldn't require finding the actual log that the tree came from.
Want to share? Thank Mark for sharing his experience with us. We're talking about tree poaching and the culture surrounding it. We have the author Lindsay Borgun. She's written a new book called Tree Thieves. What are the legal consequences for cutting down a tree illegally? Do they vary from state to state? Vary if it depends on public land versus private land?
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, there are numerous ways that the consequences are determined, but one of them is public versus private. Poaching from national parks is actually stealing from the federal government. So that has a different sort of punishment to it than perhaps stealing from state natural resource land. Often the punishment is handed down as a fine, and that fine is determined through a number of ways, particularly, you know, the worth of the wood on the market. And so it can seem that the punishment is quite low, particularly for some of these iconic trees that you might hear about. So poaching of redwood, one of the cases that I follow in the book, I think in the end they valued the tree at only worth $1,000, but the theft itself had occurred from an old growth redwood. So that, you know, there's a lot of debate around how that worth comes about. You know, sometimes that financial penalty is paid and sometimes it isn't, depending on the person who's charged.
We have Ross with us from Crawford County. Hi, Ross. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. One thought, and then, I'm thinking, like, in Wisconsin, we have a couple of national forests and some state forests, and they're mostly in the north part of the state. I live in the south. But when I do get up there and you walk around, I think I'm going to have a different take if I hear a chainsaw. I probably would have thought in the past that it would have just been normal operations to hear a chainsaw in a national forest. But now I'm kind of thinking I may have to think twice about that. But the question is kind of like addressed by Mark and by your last comments. But it sounds to me like the effort that I'm imagining that it's the Forest Service that does all the investigation, the rangers of the Forest Service, and they have to ask themselves, you know, how much effort do we put into this if the tree is, even though it's a beautiful multi-hundred-year-old tree, ultimately it's only worth so much. You kind of wonder, like, is it worth it? And if it is worth, you know, if they are going to do this, I suppose they have to target it towards the more valuable trees, which I would think out in California would be the redwoods, maybe some old growth forest or something like that in British Columbia. In Wisconsin, I don't know if our trees are worth that much besides maybe some beautiful walnut trees, but that's kind of what I was asking and thinking.
Thanks, Ross. Lindsay, what do you say to what Ross had to say?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that it depends on how we determine worth, which is a really interesting question. So there's financial worth, but there's also ecological worth, cultural worth. I know that for one of the cases that I discuss from Washington, they also took into account the cultural indicators of how a cedar tree is used by local indigenous groups, and the kind of gravity of what it means to take a tree from those traditional lands. And so there's a lot of really interesting conversations to be had around worth, because I think you're right that some rangers may see this as a lot of effort poured into investigating something that might not pay off financially. However, it is their job to protect the forest, and the forest has multiple worths. So, you know, I think it depends on how we look at it, and also the precedent that's set by not investigating it as well is part of their decision there on if they're going to really put in the legwork. There are multiple, like, hundreds of cases every year that are not investigated because it would just take way too much effort to find even the kind of slightest bit of information to find a poacher and charge them. So when I was spending time with rangers in British Columbia, you know, we were driving down a Forest Service road. It wasn't a national park, but it was forest land that's managed kind of, I mean, I'd imagine you have the same in Wisconsin, where it's managed by the state and sometimes there's selective logging on it. And often there isn't, though, because there's old growth. And so it's managed in that way. And, you know, in the span of an hour, we came across three poaching sites, and they were all brand new to the ranger who was taking me. So it was quite a shocking moment. And really, they took down all the information, and then they said, you know, the chances of us actually investigating this and doing anything with this information is very low.
What
all we have are stumps.
What methods are the most successful at stopping tree poaching then? What mm-hmm. works?
Local informants seem to be the kind of biggest, kind of most effective way of investigating who took wood. So, you know, in the Redwoods, there's a town that's right on the edge of Redwood National Park where a lot of poaching is based out of. And it has become a sort of town tradition there that folks will enter into the national park and poach redwood or poach burl. And the rangers, the Redwood National Park rangers there, they really rely on local informants to inform them who they have heard may have taken wood and where they took it to. So that remains really the kind of biggest thing that they rely on. Rangers and law enforcement, you know, they rely on hidden cameras in tree branches. That, you know, that is a pretty wide scale or a pretty widely used method of kind of deterrence, or they hope that it's a deterrent, but also an investigatory tool. Traffic stops. So pulling folks over if they see a truck bed full of wood and asking for the permit that might show where that wood came from.
Author and historian Lindsay Borgun is our guest. We're talking about her new book that examines the history of tree poaching in North America, and taking your calls as well. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We continue now with our discussion about the domino effect of tree poaching with historian Lindsay Borgun. Her new book focuses on forest conservation. Join in on this discussion on the environmental impact. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Esty from Madison is with us. She has a question. Hi, Esty.
Yes, good morning. I want to thank the author for the research that she has done. I think it's very important. I also think it is very important to note that really the majority of redwoods were decimated by corporations such as Maxim, which legally basically clear-cut miles upon miles upon miles of these magnificent ancient trees, 2,000, 3,000 years old, and it was all legal. And these were corporations that also used violence against people who were trying to protect these trees. And so, yeah, like I said, the majority of these trees were taken down legally, and that, I think, is a huge, huge mistaken problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Esty. Lindsay, what's your reaction to what Esty just said?
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, so a couple chapters of this book really talk about the kind of vast deforestation that occurred in the Pacific Northwest and really across the United States, kind of from early 20th century until the late 20th century. And it really culminated in something called the Timber Wars, which took over the West Coast in the early 1990s. And I think you're absolutely right. Not only did these corporations clear cut way beyond sustainable levels of that logging could ever kind of maintain, but they, you know, it ended up being really exploitative of the workers as well. It created a really tense situation where people felt torn between their work and their need to survive, and the perhaps knowledge that this industry then wasn't going to last forever because cutting was happening at a sustainable rate. And a lot of those corporations took advantage of that financial insecurity and encouraged folks to just not question it and just to say, we are the, you know, this is how you maintain your lifestyle. This is what feeds your family. This is what keeps your town running. And therefore, if you disagree with it, you're against logging. And so they created these kind of manufactured dissent between you're either for logging or against it, as opposed to any sort of gray area that, you know, there could be some logging that was sustainable and happened at sustainable levels, as opposed to no logging at all or clear-cut logging. So I completely agree. And there was a lot of tactics involved in getting the public really whipped up and polarized around this topic. The kind of legacy of that is still around, especially in some of these counties that really were the hotbed of a lot of both anti-logging protest and clear-cut logging practice. And people are from these regions. They call this region home. So once the timber wars had kind of settled down and a lot of logging had stopped, there were still folks left in the rubble, you know, and thinking, okay, well, now I don't have as much stability as I used to. There's not as much jobs. I have nowhere else to go. This is where I'm from, where I love my family to live, and I love the area. And a lot of resentment has been kind of built up around that. So I think there was actually a lot of like very targeted corporate messaging around this that perhaps they used to kind of shroud the fact that they were just clear-cut logging at an unsustainable level. And a little bit of that legacy of that has led to poaching. I mean, when I'm talking to people that poach today and I'm hearing them say, you know, I lived here in the 90s and I remember the way that people spoke to me and I remember the way that people talked about my profession, and it was very insulting, and, you know, I still feel very angry and upset about it. And therefore I poach because I see it as a sort of form of rebellion against that. I mean, that is a legacy that is left behind.
We're talking about illegal tree poaching with author Lindsay Borgun. We have about 3 minutes left together in our time, and Steve is calling from northern Wisconsin. Hi, Steve.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
It seems like law enforcement is unable or unwilling to do anything. I'm wondering what Lindsay thinks about groups that spike trees, that, you know, mother trees, precious old growth trees. They spike them, label them, so they're unsafe to cut and basically protected forever. Why not do more of that?
Lindsay, what's the answer to that?
That's a good question. I mean, there is a long, very controversial history around tree spiking, as I'm sure you might know, which is that tree spiking was also used as a protest measure during the timber wars, actually. Like I was just talking about, you know, many environmentalists would spike a tree because, you know, ideally a logging company would see that it had been spiked and leave the tree to stand, exactly like you're saying, kind of preserving its life. But sometimes the corporation would require loggers to just cut into those trees anyway, and it would be a really dangerous thing because the spike could ricochet off and kill somebody. And, you know, it was often seen as being a really dangerous form of protest. But that's certainly one way that you could do it. You know, I actually don't know a ton about what spiking does to the tree itself if you leave it. And you really are hoping that someone will notice that the tree has been spiked and therefore know that the risk is there and not take it. So.
You say that people are stealing more than timber from forests as well. In the minute we have left, what other natural resources are being taken? Oh.
Yeah, I could go on and on. So, you know, boughs off of trees at Christmas time, moss, you know, is sold to florists and that moss is taken up off of the forest floor. I think it goes for about $1 a pound. The needles from longleaf pine in North Carolina in general, it's dubbed brown gold, and it is very, very lucrative for the landscaping industry. Mushrooms, ferns, succulents, you know, there was, at the time that I was reporting in Northern California, there was a really big case of succulent poaching that was happening in the park at the same time, where rangers had kind of come around a bend and seen people scaling a cliff. So this particular park, you know, it actually goes right into the Pacific Ocean. It includes cliff sides and a little bit of the ocean itself. And people would scale these cliff sides and pluck succulents off the sides of the rocks where they grew. And they were selling them online through Etsy.
Lindsay, that is so interesting. And I want to thank you for joining us, as all the time we have. But thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Borgun. She is a writer, oral historian, and 2018 National Geographic Explorer based in British Columbia, author of Tree Thieves. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.